Hello and welcome to Saturday the 15th of December's edition of Dialect. We'll come to you from the Headley Radio Room at Bristol's Empire and Commonwealth Museum by the Temple Mead Station. This is our last show before the Christmas break, so we'll be trying out some live reporting on Bristol's big stories. Plus, we have a listen to some cathedral music and find out what's going on over there over the break. There's some live music from Justin Fellows, and we have a few surprises as ever, plus our main man Jeff Sparks is here with his weekly What's On Guide. And that's all after the news with Tony Gosling.
The entire board of an unelected government body which scrapped the multi-million pound Bristol Arena project should resign, a leading councillor has demanded. Former Lord Mayor Peter Abraham said the decision to axe the scheme was a scandalous waste of 7 years' work and of £30 million. The South West Regional Development Agency, a quango which is funded entirely by taxpayers' money, was the main driver behind the failed arena project. Its aim was to fulfil the city's dream of a 10,000-seat arena on a formal diesel depot next to Temple Mead Station to attract major stars. Yesterday, the Evening Post reported in later editions that the agency, which is responsible for promoting economic growth in the West, had announced the dream was over. An arena will cost the taxpayer up to £86 million, a price that was too high to pay, the RDA said. But Mr Abraham, Bristol's Deputy Lord Mayor and a former Conservative group leader on the City Council, said, "What's the use of them if they're going to muck us around like this? The project was vital to the city. People are fed up with having to go to Cardiff and London to see the major acts. This arena would have made Bristol the true capital of the South West. These people on the RDA have spent millions. They've mucked us about year after year saying they were going to do this thing. So what's the point of them? I think they should all resign." The £250 million arena was to have been the jewel in the crown of Temple Quay development. Behind it was a consortium of public and private investors, including the City Council, which was prepared to contribute £4 million in cash and £12 million worth of land. But having already spent £15 million of public money buying and cleaning up the site, the RDA felt it would be wrong to pump in another £71 million, which is what would have been necessary to bring the project to fruition. The bathroom of a Bristol home contained drilled-out woodwork possibly used to hide cameras for the filming of child sex abuse, a court heard this week. Bristol Crown Court was told police discovered the evidence in a house that a carpenter, Wayne Parfitt, had access to. When they searched the address he later shared with his mother in 8th Avenue, Filton, officers seized four miniature cameras on cables as well as video and still cameras. Parfitt, 48, denies two rapes, two attempted rapes, and four counts of having sexual activity with a child aged under 18. He further denies five counts of making an indecent photograph of a child and one count of taking an indecent photograph of a child. Detective Constable Louise Butler told the court she worked on the case as a member of the Child Abuse Investigation Team. From the witness box, she told Parfitt, "I've been a police officer on this team for 6 years, and the investigation into one of the complainants' abuse was probably the worst I've seen. Her disclosure was probably the worst disclosure I've ever had to listen to, Mr. Parfitt. She was extremely tearful and showed signs of being extremely frightened of you." The case continues. Britain's biggest house builder is to build England's first eco-village, the Housing and Planning Minister Yvette Cooper announced this week in Bristol. Barratt has won the bid to create a new community at the site of the former Hannam Hospital, which has been commissioned by the government's National Regeneration Agency, English Partnerships. The village is expected to be built in 3 years' time, ahead of the government's 2016 target, when it wants all new homes to be zero carbon. The on-site biomass, combined heat and power plant, will deliver energy to all 200 homes. The village also aims to create eco-friendly lifestyles. It will capture rainwater and include sustainable drainage, farmers' shops, a car club, and bicycle storage. The government is proposing to build 10 eco-towns that will house up to 20,000 new homeowners. Yvette Cooper said the smaller eco-villages would aid the town's development. Dialect is launching its own campaign to get Bristol City Art Gallery to display a prophetic painting by one of Bristol's most famous artists. Victorian painter Rolinda Sharples is credited as producing some of the most accurate and comprehensive pictures of ordinary life in 19th century Bristol. But her painting, The Stoppage of the Bank, which depicts long queues of hapless punters outside a fictitious Bristol bank, has been removed from the gallery by the City Council staff. The painting's remarkable in that it predicts, by more than a century, the Northern Rock crisis of this autumn, and a timely reminder to Bristol's citizens not to put too much of their faith in the banks. Some stories take a while to emerge. Take August's rogue armed B-52 story from the United States, for example. It was the end of October before that was made public. In Florida, a Florida-based Gulfstream II jet aircraft crash-landed on September the 24th, 2007, after it ran out of fuel over Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. At the crash site, it turned out that it had a cargo of several tons of cocaine on board. Documents have turned up on both sides of the Atlantic that link this to the CIA, who used it on at least three rendition flights from Europe and the USA to Guantanamo's infamous torture chambers between 2003 and 2005. The story emerged in Miami Herald's Spanish-language edition called Nuevo Herald, and had been discussed in depth on the Expert Witness program on 99.5 FM in New York City, a show hosted by one of the most highly decorated drug enforcement agents in U.S. history, Michael Levine. The Gulfstream jet was initially reported by the Mexican press as carrying a huge cargo of more than 6 tons of cocaine, as well as 1 ton of pure heroin, but a later press release, courtesy of the Mexican military, had it dwindled down to only 4 tons of cocaine with no heroin whatsoever. By early October, the Mexican press announced a third reduction, leaving only 3.7 tons of cocaine, followed a few days later with 3.6, then later a final report that gave the amount as just 3.3 tons. Draw your own conclusions about the missing 3 tons of cocaine and the ton of heroin that was first reported. Everybody is out to make money on the drug war, even the so-called good guys, if there is such a thing.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, that was Crazy Arthur Brown with Fire, and he played at the Trinity within the last month, so he's still going. God bless him. We're now going to go over to our first feature. The Severn Estuary is blessed, or cursed, depending on your point of view, with three nuclear power stations, Aldbury, Berkeley and Hinkley Point. It was announced this week that Hinkley is to be given a new lease of life by the government, and I'm joined now on the line by Jim Duffy from the Stop Hinkley campaign. Hello, Jim Duffy.
Hello there, Tony.
I'm actually John.
Hello there, John. Sorry, it was Tony I was speaking to a moment ago.
Indeed it was. I understand you're now based in Surrey. Have you sort of moved to get away from Hinkley, and how are you going to stop Hinkley from where you are now?
Well, my committee, the Stop Hinkley Committee, were very keen that I stayed on campaigning when we moved to Surrey. We're actually recruiting new people now to join us in the campaign, and we've got two people lined up who want to do a job share, basically. But I'm very committed, basically, to continuing to fight against nuclear power, not just at Hinkley Point, but anywhere in the country. I don't think it's a good idea for us to have that. But you know, the position I have at the moment is coordinator of Stop Hinkley, so I'm, you know, continuing to stick with that, basically.
Okay, so you think interest in the Hinkley campaign should perhaps be more, not just for people who are directly near Hinkley? You think it has more national importance, do you think?
It's a national issue. Hinkley is likely to be the first site where they built a new generation of nuclear power stations. And if there was an accident there, either at the with the new reactor or the existing reactor, then that would obviously affect the whole country and most of Europe, basically. So it's a national, even an international issue. So it relates to everybody in the country, really.
Okay. What is the state of play at the three Bristol nuclear sites? Which reactors are still operating?
There is only one reactor operating at the Aldbury site, that's Reactor 2. Reactor 2 is due to shut down next month in January. We're not sure whether it will reopen again. The two reactors are due to finish operating at the end of this year. Reactor 1 has been shut down for more than a year, since August, 18 months ago, and is undergoing inspections at the moment. It's slightly more damaged and slightly more deteriorated and defective than Reactor 2.
Right.
So there is a chance that that may never reopen.
Okay, so why is it Bristol's got more than its fair share of these nuclear power stations?
Yes, well, the government must have decided in its wisdom that... I think one of the reasons is the epicentre for electricity consumption is just to the west of London.
Mm.
So either you build reactors on the south coast or on the east coast or on the west coast. They've got some reactors on the east coast. They've got one on the two stations on the south coast at Dungeness, and then they decided to build three here on the Severn Estuary, which we don't like very much.
Right. So what exactly is it the government has just decided to do at Hinkley?
The government hasn't decided to do anything, but there is Hinkley A, which is being decommissioned at the moment, and our campaign was pretty instrumental in shutting that down in 2000. Hinkley B is still operating and has just got a life extension from 2011 to 2016, sanctioned by the Nuclear Installations Inspectorate. British Energy decided that they... have got the wherewithal to keep the reactor going until 2016. We've
right.
got our concerns about that. And British Energy, who own Hinkley B, have also said that they would like to have Hinkley as one of their four key sites for building nuclear power stations if, in January, the government gives the go-ahead to nuclear power as one form of future electricity generation.
Right. I mean, has climate change given nuclear power, which is obviously carbon neutral, a new lease of life?
Well, I think certainly the nuclear industry has gone on the charm offensive, and they have pretty much won over the government in this respect. It's not exactly carbon neutral because if you look at the whole nuclear life cycle from cradle to birth, then uranium mining is very intensive in carbon, as it requires explosions for the mining. One of the biggest man-made holes on the planet is in Australia, which is an open mine, basically, an open-cast uranium mine, which produces 8% of Australia's carbon emissions. So the carbon emissions might not count in Britain for nuclear power, but they are still going into the climate and still contributing to climate change.
Right.
If you add to that the decommissioning and the nuclear waste disposal and management before it's disposed of, that all tops up nuclear to possibly not as much as gas and coal, but certainly produces more carbon than renewable energy and energy conservation and district-scale energy distribution, generation, which we support.
Is Hinkley Point ready to withstand a terrorist attack?
Well, that's a key question. Certainly the European pressurised reactor, which is being built, it's called an EPR for short, is being built in Olkiluoto in Finland, and the Danish authorities have said that they're not happy that that particular reactor is aircraft proof, and they have asked Areva, who are the builders, to redesign the reactor in order to make it proof, or to prove to them that it's proof against an aircraft crash.
Right.
That will involve adding a lot more cement, which will probably stiffen the design. But stiffening a reactor design doesn't mean to say that that's helpful, because at one level you introduce more stiffness, and that basically means that the shock transmits itself to very delicate and fragile nuclear equipment within the reactor. So that may not be an answer at all to a deliberate aircraft crashing into a nuclear reactor.
I mean, this may be perhaps an obvious question that people may not be confident enough to ask as such, but what is the connection between nuclear power and nuclear weapons?
Well, certainly the first generation of nuclear power stations in this country, the Magnox reactors like Hinkley A, were built in order to produce plutonium. The plutonium was extracted from the spent fuel from the Magnox reactors, and then put into nuclear weapons. And in fact, stations like Hinkley A, as well as producing reports every month on how much electricity that they produced, they also produced reports on how much plutonium they produced. So there's a kind of boast, really, as to how much they were contributing to nuclear armament in Great Britain. That doesn't apply anymore now, though. So the future nuclear power stations won't be contributing to nuclear weapons. We've got far more plutonium than we could ever deal with, basically. There's a waste heap. Well, the government probably will label it as waste at some stage in the future, of about 50 tons of plutonium. So we don't need any more, even if anybody agreed with nuclear weapons.
Right,
so the new nuclear power stations, the new generation of nuclear power stations, will simply store the dangerous spent fuel on site. So there'll be a spent fuel site at the new Hinkley Point C, which in itself will become a terrorist target. So a colleague of mine, Hugh Richards, for Wales Anti-Nuclear Alliance, did some arithmetic on this, and he worked out that the amount of radiation that will be kept on site at these nuclear stores would be 20 times that was released by Chernobyl in the 1986 accident. A chilling thought.
So, you know, it does make what happens at Hinkley Point, you feel, definitely does make a difference to the ordinary people who live here in Bristol.
It certainly does. Bristol is only, if the wind is blowing in that direction, if there are even a minor accident where there is a release of radiation with a 10-mile-an-hour wind, then within an hour and a half, people are breathing in those toxic fumes at Bristol. If there was a major accident, then the whole of Bristol would need to be evacuated. Well, where will they go? The M5 would be clogged up. The whole of the South West Peninsula would be clogged up with traffic, people trying to get away from the toxic plume. And at Three Mile Island, the medical staff didn't even stay around against expectation. Only 10% of them were at their posts. 90% of them were away scooping up their children from school and heading off for the hills, basically. So we expect probably the same thing would happen in Britain, no doubt.
So given that the government, if they do make a decision on this, will probably just sort of plough on regardless, what's next for the Stop Hinkley campaign?
Well, we basically keep on plugging with our press releases so that we try and let the public know some of the hidden stories, the inside stories that are going on with the nuclear industry and with Hinkley Point. So we'll basically, you know, keep providing information for people. We will keep running public meetings. We had a public meeting only a month ago about the nuclear waste issue, where the government look as if they're going to proceed with the idea of having a deep repository for high-level nuclear waste, which the speaker, who was a government advisor, said this is a dangerous way forward, and that the government have leapt ahead without taking advice from its own committee to do more research into the corrosion of the containers that would be dumped into these dumps a kilometre below the surface of the earth. So we'll keep on doing public meetings, we'll keep on asking our members to write to the government, to write to MPs, and campaigning, you know, principally through the media.
Okay, so lastly, what can people do if they're listening, if they're concerned about the expansion of Hinkley? I mean, have you got a website or...?
The first thing to do is have a look at our website, which is www.stophinkley.org. And we've got links to all the other major anti-nuclear organisations. They can keep abreast of the press releases and newspaper articles that have been published through us, and basically alert their MPs and any other decision makers as to any concerns that they have. They could also get in touch with us and join our membership, and that would help bolster our funds, basically, so that we can keep on campaigning.
Okay. Well, Jim Duffy from the Stop Hinkley campaign, thank you very much for coming on. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, Dialect is about to depart for a Christmas break, and though the historical Jesus is not thought to have been born at this time of year, and Christmas is based around the time of the old pagan solstice, that thankfully won't stop the church from putting on a tremendous programme of choral music, and you'd be churlish not to find something in this next fortnight's programme to take your fancy. Dialect's Tony Gosling dropped into Bristol Cathedral earlier this week.
My name is Mark Lee and I'm the Director of Music at Bristol Cathedral. My main responsibility is choosing the music that the Cathedral Choir sings, training them to sing it, and then conducting them in the performance of it.
That sounds like quite an onerous task. Fantastic. I mean, are you quite a busy chap?
Yeah, I think organisation is the key. The day starts at 8:15 when we have chorister rehearsals for about an hour or so. And then it's a question of planning the day very carefully to make sure all the admin work gets done before the choristers come back later on in the afternoon for more rehearsal. Then the lower voices of the choir, the grown-ups, come in for more rehearsal on top of that. And then we sing the service, and that's almost our daily routine.
So, yeah, we're going to be talking in a minute about what's happening over Christmas. But for just passers-by during the week and maybe weekends, people in Bristol that haven't been to the cathedral for a while, what's the weekly routine during the year?
Well, basically, the daily office, the daily service, is choral evensong, and you can hear that sung in the cathedral most days of the week. On Monday and Tuesday, you can hear it sung by the full choir. That's the choir of boys or girls and men. On Wednesday, you can hear it sung just by the boy choristers. Thursday, our girls' choir normally sings the service, and on Friday, you can hear it sung by the lay clerks. That's the adult professionals of the choir who sing alto, tenor and bass. On the weekend, we sing on Saturday. We sing choral evensong again in the afternoon at 3:30. And there are two services on Sunday. There's a 10 o'clock Eucharist, which I suppose is the principal service of the week. And in the afternoon at 3:30, evensong. So you can pretty well be guaranteed to hear some choral service in the cathedral most days of the week.
Okay, so let's move on to talk about this Christmas and what's happening. So can you take us through the sort of variety of stuff that will be going on here?
Well, the cathedral is incredibly busy over Christmas, as you might expect. There's any number of Christmas musical activities going on. As far as activities involving, as it were, the home team, I mean, we also welcome an enormous number of visiting groups to the cathedral. But you can also hear the daily round of services that I described before, in addition to which you can pick up things like, for example, on Friday, the Cathedral Choir is giving its annual Christmas concert entitled Carols by Candlelight, when you can hear a variety of sacred and secular music. I think one of the highlights of the concert is probably hearing a robed choir of boys, girls and men singing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. One of the many delights of that particular event, that's interspersed with some suitable readings. On Saturday, you can hear the Cathedral Chamber Choir together with the Emerald Ensemble performing Handel's Messiah, which again has become a traditional Christmas fixture at the Cathedral. On Saturday of next week, we have a children's carol service, Christingle service. You can hear the choristers, that's boys and girls, singing together there. Our traditional Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols has proved so popular. It's previously always been on Christmas Eve, 24th of December. I think we had about 1,200 people present last year. We've decided to repeat it this year, do it twice, 23rd and 24th, exactly the same event, try and spread the load a little bit. That will be very much traditional Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols, the traditional Christmas readings, and a whole variety of music performed by what we call the Great Choir, which is basically all our musical resources put together. It's our girls' choir, our girl and boy choristers, and our lay clerks. And then Christmas morning, you would have the opportunity to hear a festival Eucharist sung with orchestra by the Cathedral Choir. In addition to which, the Cathedral also has a large choral society called the Bristol Cathedral Concert Choir, and they're giving two Christmas concerts with full symphony orchestra on Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. So there's no shortage of Christmas music to be heard.
What about as we move into the new year? Do you do anything special around that time? Because obviously for most people it's a long holiday with these sort of two things going on, Christmas and New Year. So do you do anything around the new year, or is that nothing special particularly?
I think probably collapse and rest is what we do around that period. After Christmas Day, we finish sort of Christmas lunchtime after the Eucharist service. Then we're basically free until Epiphany, and we meet again on Epiphany Sunday. We sing a Eucharist in the morning. We have an Epiphany carol service in the afternoon, and then essentially we're back into the regular round of services as described before.
How important do you think music is in the life of the cathedral and in any church, I suppose?
I think music is incredibly important in the life of any cathedral, certainly in the life of this one, and I'm sure that that any cathedral would agree with that. It's a way of accessing emotions and feelings and aspects of worship that are really impossible to access in any other way. I think particularly in this building, which has the most amazing acoustic, the sort of combination of soaring treble voices and wonderful resonant acoustic really does create a remarkable atmosphere. It can be very relaxing. It's quite an anonymous style of worship for choral evensong. It's not a service that you feel you have to participate in. There is a hymn at the end of each service for everyone to join in, but it is essentially a chance for the choir to provide music on the behalf of the congregation. And if you want to just sit back and let it all wash over you, the opportunity is there.
I think many people will be surprised that they can come along and hear choral evensong every night, pretty much of the year.
Yes, I suppose so. That's true.
Or evening, should I say, or late afternoon, early evening.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. Well, you can hear choral evensong sung in that way in most cathedrals in the country. It is a bit of a sort of undiscovered gem, I suppose, of English culture as much as anything else. You know, you're listening to a professional choir that rehearses every day, music of outstanding beauty and quality. I mean, in a building of this architectural magnificence, only the best music, artistically speaking, really is appropriate to be performed. So you can hear magnificent music, very, very finely performed indeed. It won't cost you a penny. You can just come in and enjoy the atmosphere.
There's some starting up just now.
Well, we have Radio Bristol Carol Concert tonight, for which I have the pleasure of playing the organ, and the team have been in most of the day setting up the sound equipment and getting the instruments organised.
The choirs that you have, are they all from the Cathedral School, the youngsters?
The youngsters, yeah, pretty much all from the Cathedral School. There's been a boys' choir, boy choristers here, since the Cathedral was first founded in 1542. So that's over 450 years of boy choristers singing here, and there may well have been boys before that back in the cathedral's Augustinian Abbey roots. The Cathedral School became co-educational a couple of years ago, and in response to that, we set up a an alternative girls' top line, with the idea of being able to run two separate teams, girls and boys, and that's proving to be very successful. Girls' Choir is, the girl choristers, rather, are still, I suppose, in their infancy, but they're doing extremely well, and we're getting to the stage where we're going to be able to share the workload between the two quite soon. They're all pupils at the Cathedral School, which is our sister foundation. The Cathedral and the school have both been in existence since the 12th century, so they have a long history that going back together. And our girls' choir, which is an 11 to 18 group of girls, the group that sings on Thursday afternoon evensong, and occasional Sundays, that's a group that's drawn from schools across the city. So that provides a little bit of diversity in our musical diet.
For those on the internet, is there anywhere central that they can come to have a look for events that are going on at the cathedral, musical events?
There is. There's a very good newly refurbished cathedral website, www.bristol-cathedral.co.uk, and a trawl through that will tell you almost everything you need to know about the cathedral and all the people who work here. You can see the full list of music. You can find out about the people who work on the music as well as the many other aspects of the cathedral. And there's also an events page. You can see exactly what's coming up in very clear detail and how to obtain tickets for things for which you might need tickets.
Tremendous acoustics from Bristol Cathedral there, and that was Mark Lee giving us a taster of what's on over the festive season. The website again is www.bristol-cathedral.co.uk, and you can phone them too during office hours on 0117 926 4879. And now, without further ado, over to Little Gaia. Thank you.
short little time to be living. Wanna make sure I'm giving. Make sure I'm giving. Get into the positive and you'll shine right with yours. Couldn't be more simple. The wonderful is what you search. Get into the positive and you'll shine right with yours. Couldn't be more simple. Couldn't be more simple.
Excellent, thank you very much. So Little Gara is made up of, I understand, Justin?
Yes, that's me.
And Rainey.
Rainey, all right. I understand you've got some gigs coming up soon. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, we're playing in Mr. Wolf's in Bristol. Mr. Wolf's in Bristol on the 22nd of December, so a couple of days before Christmas. And yeah, just the two of us, isn't it, this time?
Yeah.
Just playing as a duo, so it should be fun.
How long have you been going?
Justin and I have played together for, quite a long time now, hasn't it? It's been a few years, but recently just sort of got back together and got the band together this year, really.
Okay, is it usually sort of a two-piece, or are you
kind of... Well, we're actually on the lookout for a bass player at the moment.
Advert, bass player required.
But yeah, we're just doing it in a stripped-down acoustic format at the moment, but we'd like to do bigger shows as well with more of a rocky sound.
Cool.
As well.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, do you want to play another? We've got time for another one? Yep, absolutely. We'll crack on. Let's do some more.
Just send a message to you.
send a message to you. Just 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 send a message to you.
Thank you.
Well, if you didn't tap your foot to that, then you've got to be asleep or dead, I reckon. That was fantastic. So what are your influences?
Loads of stuff, isn't it, really?
Me, I like a lot of world music. Latin and African music. And yeah. Anything you can dance to, really. A lot of funk and even dance music, a lot of electronic stuff. You know, anything that's drum heavy and percussion heavy.
Yeah, okay.
I'm into.
Do you play sort of drums as in the full...
Full drum kit as well, yeah. Say when we're doing the full band, we have a drum kit there as well as a percussion.
Wicked, all right. So have you got like a website people can look at and check out?
Yeah, the website's a MySpace site, www.myspace/littlegaia.
Little Gaia, how do you spell that? Little.
That's G-A-I-A.
Okay, Little Gaia. Yeah. Okay, excellent. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now time for this week's archive slots. We're going to have Myrtle Travers, I believe, living in India, who's a colonel, and this is him.
I had a parakeet, which I... caught in my butterfly net. It used to go around climbing trees in the garden with me, and I taught it to talk quite a bit. And it used to come on the pony with me, sit on the saddle when I went riding. It used to garden with mother, not very helpful. And my father used to always, he got up very early and went off onto the estate at dawn, and then he used to come back and have a late breakfast. And then he always had a siesta on one of those long chairs, which we were quite famous for, which had long arms that you could rest your feet on. And he would be sitting on the veranda with his feet up along this long arm, fast asleep, and the parrot always used to sit on the toe of his shoe, equally fast asleep.
You will have spotted, obviously, that was the colonel with a rather high voice. Possibly didn't go quite right during puberty. No, that was not a colonel at all. That was colonial, was in fact the word I was looking at, and I misread it, so I do apologise. We have Jeff Sparks in the studio. I understand you've been in the Evening Post.
Yes, I have. It's a group I've recently formed on Facebook.com, a group called Save Historic Bristol. And basically the aims of the group are to raise awareness of historical important buildings or socially important buildings in Bristol and to preserve them and hopefully reuse them for future generations.
All right. Have you got any sort of specific buildings that people may know about?
At the moment, we've got five buildings on the list. We've got the birthplace of Thomas Chatterton. We've got the Palace Hotel in Old Market, St. James's Church in Whitson Street, St. Michael on the Mount Without on St. Michael's Hill. And we have a property on St. Michael's Hill called Cogent House.
So who are your friends on Facebook?
At the moment we have roughly 51 members, and they're mainly local MPs and councillors, and just general members of the public who are interested in saving historic Bristol.
Well, I find that sort of pretty hard to disagree with, so go and check it out on Facebook. And if you're not a member already, probably half the people you know probably are on Facebook, so go and check it out, sign up, and save historic Bristol.
Yep, thank you. Okay, good afternoon. This is the What's On Guide from Radio Dialect, starting with Thursday, 20th of December, at the Rondo Theatre in Bath. Stackridge will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. And tickets are £10 on the door and £8 for concessions. And they're also playing the same venue on Saturday, 22nd of December. Keeping with Thursday night, at the Fleece and Firkin in St. Thomas Street in Bristol, the Communicators will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are at £7 in advance. Now we come to a song of the week, and this week I decided to play you a Christmas tune. This is Lou Monte with the track Dominic the Donkey.
Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the Donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La 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 la. Santa's got a little friend, his name is Dominic. The cutest little donkey, you'll never see him kick. When Santa visits his paisans with Dominic, he'll be. Because the reindeer cannot climb the hills of Italy. Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La la la, la 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 la. La la la, la 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 la. Jingle bells around his feet and presents on the sled. Hey, look at the Mayor's Derby on top of Dominic's head. A pair of shoes for Louis and a dress for Josephine. The label on the inside says they're made in Brooklyn. Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the Donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La la la, la 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 la. La la la, la 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 la. Children sing and clap their hands and Dominic starts to dance. They talk Italian to him and he even understands. Gumbadas and gumbadas do they dance a da da del. When Santa Nicola comes to town and brings old Chucharil. Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La la la, la 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 la. La la la, la 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 de da.
Hey, Dominic, want another dollar?
That was Lou Monte with Dominic the Donkey. Just a little Christmas tune for you all right there. Moving on to Friday, 21st of December at Mr. Wolf's in Bristol. The John E. Vistick Experience will be performing with support from Geoff Lawson, Emily Breeze and Irish Neil. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Also on Friday, 21st of December, the Transpersonals will be performing at the Hatchet in Bristol with support from Ulysses. Doors open at 9:30 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Moving on to Saturday, 22nd of December. At the Croft, Three Hoes, Two Mexicans and a Tin of Spanners will be performing with support from the Get Outs. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Finally, on to Sunday, 23rd of December. Playing at the Fleece and Firkin in Bristol, the Jimi Hendrix tribute group Are You Experienced will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. That is all from me today. Thank you for listening. Have a good Christmas. Take care and goodbye.
And that was a Jefferson Airplane track that Tony Gosling brought in. Thank you for that. In the news this week is the spectacular abandonment of what was supposed to be a spectacular project, the Bristol Arena. We had hoped here on Dialect to bring you an interview from the South West Regional Development Agency, who were responsible for the scheme's cancellation. Hello. But we were told yesterday that nobody was available, and this really is absurd for an organisation which is funded by our taxes and is supposed to represent...
Laura Haskell speaking.
Oh, hi. My name's John. I'm from Dialect Radio. I'm calling about the cancellation of the arena project, and I was looking for more information on it.
Right. I can't actually hear you very well. There's really bad reception.
Okay.
Sorry, one moment. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you well. Can you hear me okay? Hello, Eudora Pascal. Can you hear me all right? Okay, I think we may have lost Eudora Pascal, the press officer for the South West Regional Development Agency for the moment. Unless she's there. Hello, can you hear me at all? No. Okay, it's gone. Mysteriously, suddenly lost reception. However, despite the fact that they are supposed to be representing the views of the public, nobody... has felt able to explain his decision that they have taken with our public money, and that includes today, and that includes our attempt just then. So perhaps we will try again next week, who knows. But yes, the Bristol Arena was going to be sort of like the NEC, except for Bristol, like a big music arena, has been mysteriously cancelled, and nobody has successfully been able to tell us why. So we will try again next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, that's all for Dialect Radio this year, 2007. This show was recorded in the Headley Radio Room in the British Empire and Commonwealth Museum by Bristol's Temple Meads Railway Station. Dialect is a community internet radio station run by the Bristol Broadband Cooperative, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to get involved, either in reporting, production, or on the engineering side, please do get in touch by calling Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web at www.bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Today's studio manager was Villis Chitchikuran, and the reporters were Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. The presenter was me, John Peters Coleman, and also thank you to Jeff Sparks for his What's On Guide. Thanks to our guests, Little Gaia, that was Justin and Rainer, and I remember they're playing at Mr. Wolf's on the 22nd. The producer was Tony Gosling. We'll look forward to your company again on Saturday the 12th of January 2008, Dialect's unique blend of arts and news from Bristol to Bristol and the globe. From me, Jordan, and the rest of the Dialect team, have a very good Christmas, and we'll see you in the new year. Take care.